fans, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. We're now 23 days away to the kickoff of the World Cup football tournament in Russia. And how about another fun World Cup fact for our VOA listeners? 23 also was the age of Uruguay's Alcides Guija when he scored the winning goal against host Brazil in the 1950 World Cup final at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. A record crowd of 199,854 attended the game, described as the most disappointing match in Brazilian football history. Guija delivered his decisive goal in the 79th minute to lift Uruguay to a 2-1 victory over Brazil. And he also delivered a winning quote years later. Only three people have ever silenced 200,000 people at the Maracanã with a single gesture. Frank Sinatra, Pope John Paul II, and me. The Uruguayan winger was the last surviving player from the game, which came to be known as Maracanazo, roughly translated as the Maracanã blow. Alcides Guija died on July 16, 2015, exactly 65 years after scoring his big goal at the age of 88. And I'm sure the current Uruguay football team, led by Barcelona star Luis Suarez, will have the memory of Alcides Guija in their hearts when they travel to Russia next month. The 1950 team with Guija was the last Uruguay squad to lift the World Cup trophy. Uruguay also won the inaugural World Cup in 1930, when it hosted the tournament. Uruguay is in Group A at the 2018 World Cup, along with Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and host Russia. Uruguay will go against Egypt June 15th in the opening World Cup match for both teams in Yekaterinburg, Russia. The Pharaohs of Egypt are one of five African teams that will compete in Russia. The four others are the Atlas Lions of Morocco, the Super Eagles of Nigeria, the Lions of Teranga of Senegal, and the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia. What makes African soccer unique? And what makes African soccer different, both as a culture and a style of play? To find out the answers to those questions, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Duke University history professor Laurent Dubois, the author of a new book, The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Dubois begins their conversation by telling Adam that soccer is a truly universal passion.
I say in the book, I think it's the most widely shared form of human culture, period. I mean, there are obviously music and religion, but this is a very specific game that is played all over the place, almost a universal language that almost anywhere on the planet, if you didn't speak any other language, you might find this as a kind of common ground.
Even though soccer is universally played, your book draws a lot on the work of the historian Peter Alleghi, who wrote a book called African Soccerscapes.
He really argues that the modern game of soccer, the way it's played globally, has really been shaped by African styles of play and African players over the years. Especially starting in the 50s and 60s, the way that Africans played really became a kind of global phenomenon.
What is the African style of play that you allude to? You say that they sort of made it their own.
It's hard to generalize about the whole continent, but there definitely is a strong premium on certain kinds of very creative, technically brilliant play, to dribble around other players, you know, to kick the ball in kind of extraordinary ways. That's valued by coaches and it's valued by fans, and it becomes kind of part of the style. But so there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between what the people want to see and then what players do. So it's not necessarily, you know, ingrained in the culture, but there are these kind of preferences that emerge over time and that people see, you know, certain kinds of play as particularly great play.
Your book also talks about African soccer culture and its interplay with African history and the history of colonialism as well. Tell me how those two go together.
The origins of the sport are definitely in colonialism, and it's brought to the continent by English missionaries, by English teachers, in the French colonies as well. So part of it is there's always a kind of pleasure in beating the colonial rulers at their own game, right? But what also happens is that people find that in colonial societies, the soccer team becomes a really new, powerful way to articulate local belonging. Sometimes ethnic groups, you know, form their own soccer teams. There are a lot of teams that are founded in Cameroon and elsewhere that have a particular kind of identity as a location or a group, and they kind of then carry the pride of that group, right? And they can kind of compete either against white colonial teams or other African teams. And then once you get to the period of decolonization and independence, the two things that new African countries do is to join the United Nations and join FIFA and become part of the Federation of Football. Playing on the international scale, having teams on the international scale becomes a really important way for African countries to be on the global stage and sort of take pride in their presence there.
In Africa, the relationship between politics and sport didn't just end with decolonization. It also had a lot to do with sort of promoting a national pride.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Senegal or a nation like Cameroon, which has also had a very storied career internationally, Ghana also, all these nations, I think the national soccer teams do become, you know, very potent symbols.
Tell me more about how national pride and culture played out in Senegal, for example.
In the book, I tell the story of a man known as Alou. His full name was Alassane Ndiaye, who was a school teacher and kind of intellectual in Senegal, who kind of by accident ended up becoming a commentator for radio matches and becoming this kind of great commentator in Senegal. And what he was able to do was he would take the kind of traditions of griot storytelling and kind of epic stories in West Africa and use those to kind of infuse the way he narrated a match. And as such, he was kind of teaching people to see in the game a kind of reflection of their broader, deeper culture and literature.
Of course, something that distinguishes African soccer overall from Western and American soccer is that in Africa, soccer teams often don't have the material resources and support that soccer players get at the highest levels in the United States and Europe.
It's true that all over the world, obviously, infrastructure helps. You know, when people have access to fields and those sorts of things, that makes a big difference. At the same time, you know, people can learn to play the game even in very modest conditions, as long as they have a ball and a place to play. And in some ways, growing up in places where it's hard to play, where the ground is rough, forces you to develop really great technique. And that can then develop, you know, really strong players as well. The point is that soccer fans all over the world, they want to win, of course, but they also like their teams to play a certain kind of game, to see a certain kind of spectacle. And they take pride when their players play a kind of what they consider to be a beautiful style. So it's not only about winning, it's also about kind of embodying certain kind of values that they want to see embodied on the pitch.
Is there a difference between sub-Saharan soccer and football and, say, you know, in the north where it's more Arab-based?
It's interesting because in this year's World Cup, actually, three of the African teams are from North Africa, which is unusual. It's true that Egypt has a very deep, old history of soccer. They were actually one of the earliest nations to join FIFA, and there's different styles of play there. In West Africa, of course, the current situation is one in which, because a lot of the African professional leagues are kind of underfunded and don't have enough money, the aspiration of a lot of African players is to go play in Europe, and many of the best players do play in Europe. So you do have this kind of interesting situation, almost maybe a certain kind of neo-colonial relationship, where the top of the African players are brought into Europe. And while they can make a lot of money there, there's a kind of inequality in terms of funding between African soccer and European soccer that recapitulates other kinds of relationships that are ongoing.
You mentioned in the book, and you illustrate beautifully, how history and heritage, broadly understood, is a part of what a lot of fans bring to games.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what the African audiences of this year's World Cup will be bringing.
Well, for one thing, Senegal is in the World Cup for the first time in a long time, and Senegal has one of the best records of a team in the past, so I think there's a lot of hope around them. It's also true and very interesting that especially teams like France and Belgium, but other Europeans too, have a lot of players of African background who are very tied to Africa. So when you watch the Belgian team, you're going to see players of Congolese background, and in the French team, you know, West African and Caribbean players. So there is some of that too. People will kind of see representatives of their countries playing on European teams. Sometimes they might root for the team for that reason, or might be ambiguous. In other words, a lot of these European teams are very much shaped by the migrant histories from Africa, whether it's North Africa or West Africa. But I think, you know, there's always a hope, obviously, that the African teams will do well. And there's always a lot of worry that because the support from federations is not as good as the European ones, the funding is not as good. You know, and there's been teams that have been very talented, but have gone into the World Cup and really crashed and burned. So I think there's a mix of hope and fear that you kind of bring to these tournaments because of some difficult experiences in the past for African teams. And one of the biggest other inequalities is that, I mean, although there's almost as many countries in Africa as there are in Europe, you know, there's far fewer slots for African countries in the World Cup than European countries. So they just have a harder time getting into the World Cup. There's only five slots, whereas European teams have many, many more.
Why is that?
Basically, because FIFA's been European dominated for a long time. And actually, Kwame Nkrumah in 66 led a boycott of the World Cup by African teams. If you can believe it, in 66, there was only one slot for either a team from Asia or Africa. And they had to compete each other to get in, right? So it's gotten better since 66, but it's still really unequal. And so what, you know, the FIFA will say is, well, the quality isn't good enough in African teams. But of course, what African proponents of more spots will say, you know, you need to be able to get to the World Cup to kind of gain the experience. There's going to be World Cup expansion and there'll be more spaces for African teams in the future. But the fact of the matter is it's hard to get in at all. And so once you're there, the stakes are all the more higher.
I know that the way people deal with referees, the teams and players' relationship to the rules might be different culturally between, say, the United States and some African countries. Do you agree with that? And if so, could you explain to me how that boils down in your view?
Well, a lot of the sports culture in the United States has a kind of real focus on fairness and, in fact, rationalizing the sport, which is why most of our sports use extensive video replay and kind of analysis, whereas soccer is starting to do that, but there's a lot of decisions that have to be made immediately by the referee, which means there's a lot of room for human error. And my argument in the book is that I think that actually contributes to the theatricality of the game, which is part of what contributes to its popularity. There's a lot of calls that could go one way or another, just depending on the referee and what they saw and exactly what you do. So there's a whole kind of arsenal that a soccer player has to have, which has to do with influencing the referee. And I love to watch that and see how they're doing it. The rule of thumb is that when a player does well, maybe dives and gets a foul and you're rooting for that team, you always love it. When the other team does it, it's outrageous and you hate it, right? So there's a way in which, depending on what way it goes for you, you might have different ethics about it. But I also think what it does is it allows for you to really appreciate certain kinds of players who are able to figure out the whole situation, including what the referee is going to do, and kind of maximize their success in that situation using all the tools at their disposal.
And this is a little bit emblematic of political and social cultures in a lot of African countries, where there may be rules written down, but there's a certain amount of finesse that you need to have in order to negotiate your way through it.
I mean, again, people appreciate the sport because a lot of the ambiguities that you see in the sport are ambiguities you'll also experience in your real life, right? So the referee is not exactly a, you know, an arbiter of justice fully. I mean, they're there to represent the rules, but obviously they can be manipulated, and every situation is a little different. The direct approach to the goal is almost never possible, right? It always has to be somewhat sinuous and moving around, and, you know, so things are never obvious, right? That's true, in, I think, in life in a lot of African contexts, too. The way to get to your goal, right, is going to take a lot of twists and turns, a lot of negotiations, a lot of kind of one-on-one negotiations, as well as kind of being part of a collective. So the appreciation you have for someone who can figure out a way through this incredibly complicated network of people in their way, basically, which is the other team, you know, is something that I appreciate, because that's what people have to do in their daily lives too.
That's Laurent Dubois, author of The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And he was talking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The book was recently published by Basic Books, just ahead of the 2018 World Cup in Russia. I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. In more World Cup news, Tottenham Hotspur striker Harry Kane will wear the captain's armband for England in Russia. The announcement was made in a video published on Twitter, in which England manager Gareth Southgate said the 24-year-old Kane had outstanding leadership qualities. Kane also responded on Twitter, writing, and I quote, "A very proud day. It means a lot to be named England captain. A massive thanks to family, friends, and fans who have supported me through thick and thin." Now, England's last full-time captain was Wayne Rooney, but the armband has been worn by several players since the former Manchester United star lost his place in the squad. Harry Kane scored 30 Premier League goals for Tottenham this past season, second overall behind Egypt and Liverpool star Mohamed Salah, who bagged a record 32 goals. At the national team level, Harry Kane has scored 12 goals in 23 international appearances. England is in Group G at next month's World Cup, along with Belgium, Panama, and Tunisia. England will take on Tunisia June 18th in the opening World Cup match for both teams in Volgograd, Russia. England is making its 15th appearance in football's premier event. Its best result came in 1966 when it lifted the World Cup trophy on home soil at Wembley Stadium in London. I'm Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. On June 13th, one day before the 2018 World Cup officially kicks off in Moscow, FIFA will announce the host of the 2026 World Cup. Morocco is bidding to become the second African country, after South Africa, to host the World Cup. The Moroccans are competing against a joint bid from the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Patrick Ekeji is a former defender for Nigeria's national football team, as well as the former director general of Nigeria's National Sports Commission. Patrick tells reporter Iron Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt that he thinks Morocco has a good chance of winning the World Cup hosting rights.
Morocco is a beautiful country to start with, and they have the facilities. For you to even think about bidding to host a World Cup, it means you believe in yourself that you have the level of discipline that it takes for a country to host a World Cup. I've been to Morocco several times. Also know that Morocco is an arm's length country for vacations for European countries over the years, long before we even got to know about the beauty of Morocco. So I think that Morocco's bid for it is a good one.
There are thoughts that the joint bid by the United States of America, Canada, and Mexico would outclass and outweigh of Morocco. What's your take on this?
Joint bids is a complex organizational arrangement, very, very complex. United States is big enough to host the World Cup again, but of course, for United States to have accepted to be with other countries, I think they'll have the management competency to put it together, but the challenges are there because you have to coordinate the games, the security, everything, transport and all of that. It's very, very expensive. Morocco has the facilities, Morocco has the economy, so I think that Morocco has a good chance to outbid the others.
Let's come to Super Eagles now.
Right.
Nigeria is preparing to go to the World Cup. They're in Group B with big names like Argentina, Croatia, Iceland.
Yeah.
First, what's your take? How do you assess our preparations for the World Cup?
Our preparations for this particular World Cup have been a lot fairer than the previous World Cups. In terms of friendlies, I think they've played about, the next friendly should be about the fifth friendly or something. And NFF itself has put in a lot more effort in terms of sourcing for support and all of that stuff. I think that some of the issues that used to be problematic in the past, many of those issues have been addressed. That is a good one because the players can honestly and truthfully concentrate on doing well at the competition. Like I said, when you get to the World Cup, you never know. I am not too comfortable that we are in the same group with Iceland, not even Croatia. Croatia is not a pushover at all. They have key players in their team that is playing at the highest levels in Europe, in European League these days. So, but I believe that our boys are going to do well.
Talking about the Super Eagles players, you were a veteran of the Nigerian national team. Then it was Green Eagles.
Yeah.
You played so many matches for this country. How would you assess the players' call to come, this provisional list of 30 players? How do you see that list?
The coach that is handling the team, every coach wants to win, right? So the coach that is handling the build-up must have selected those he believes would give him the result that he aspires to. That's number one. Number two is that they are going to meet the best in the world. Remember that a country like Italy didn't qualify. So the teams that have qualified are the best in the world. There is no pushover team. And the coach is a German. Germans, for what I know about them, are a very serious group. He would give it his best. And I think he's giving it his best. So let's hope for the best.
Hoping for the best. That's Patrick Akeji, the former director general of Nigeria's National Sports Commission. And he was talking with reporter Iron Mike Mbonye in Port Harcourt, Nigeria. I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. I mentioned Liverpool's Egyptian star Mohamed Salah earlier in the show. Salah and the Reds of Liverpool are preparing for Saturday's UEFA Champions League final against two-time defending champion Real Madrid of Spain in Kiev, Ukraine. At a news conference in Madrid on Tuesday, Real manager Zinedine Zidane said his club is as hungry as ever to win a record-extending 13th European title. Zidane was also asked whether he would swap his Portuguese star Cristiano Ronaldo for mighty Mo Salah. Zidane's response, and I quote, "Of course, it's always better to have Cristiano. It's always better to have Cristiano with you because he's the best and proves it every year." Now let's go down under to Australia, where about 200 people who traveled to the country for the 2018 Commonwealth Games have applied for refugee visas, a sharp increase from previous estimates. Athletes from several nations, including members of some African teams, disappeared from the Games Village in Queensland last month. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Refugee campaigners believe some of the 200 Commonwealth Games athletes and support staff who are seeking asylum don't want to go home because they fear they'll be persecuted because of their sexuality. Another 50 participants whose visas have expired have yet to contact Australian authorities, but would still be able to apply to stay. Officials won't confirm their nationalities, but reports say they're from Cameroon, Rwanda, Sierra Leone and Uganda. Sarah Dale is a solicitor from the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, which is acting on behalf of some of the asylum seekers.
We've heard lots of examples in the media recently, such as people who fear harm based on identifying as homosexual. In a number of Commonwealth countries, it is criminalised to be homosexual. So it's certainly our experience that we will see some people who are granted protection. But as for the overall figures, we're not going to know that until the end of processing.
Initially, it was thought only about a dozen people hadn't returned home when the games in Queensland State finished in the middle of April. The official number of athletes and staff has been disclosed at a parliamentary hearing in the Australian capital, Canberra. Australia's Department of Home Affairs said it would try to assess the applications as quickly as possible, but didn't specify how long the process would take. The assessment of some of the claims has already started. About 8,000 people arrived in Australia for the Commonwealth Games, an event held every 4 years that brings together members of a global grouping that emerged at the end of the British Empire. In 2006, after the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, 45 people either overstayed their visas or claimed asylum in Australia. The government in Canberra is increasing its annual intake of refugees this year to 18,750 people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thanks, Phil. Finally, in National Basketball Association playoff action Monday night, the Cleveland Cavaliers defeated the visiting Boston Celtics 111-102 to even the Eastern Conference Finals at two games each. LeBron James once again led the way for the Cavs, scoring a game-high 44 points. Game 5 is Wednesday night in Boston, where the Celtics are unbeaten in the playoffs, having won all 9 of their home games. And that wraps up the May 22nd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Linus Rimkus. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The illegal trafficking of endangered wildlife has escalated to alarming levels. Animals are being killed at unprecedented rate, not at the hands of small-time poachers, but by well-equipped, well-organized, global criminal networks. Wildlife trafficking is a multi-billion-dollar transnational organized crime activity and a critical conservation issue. It pushes iconic species to the brink of extinction, restricts economic development, threatens security and stability, and undermines the rule of law, said Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, Richard Glenn. For these reasons, stopping wildlife trafficking is a priority for the U.S. government. In many respects, wildlife trafficking is not much different from other violent, destructive, bloody, and profitable criminal enterprises. So it makes sense that the Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement, or INL, with its long experience in countering transnational criminal organizations that traffic in drugs, should play a key role in the development and implementation of anti-wildlife trafficking policies around the world. Indeed, INL has found that the tools and resources developed fighting other forms of trafficking can be applied to the wildlife arena, said Mr. Glenn. Criminal organizations move freely across national borders as they traffic poached wildlife from source countries to buyers all over the world. If these criminals cannot find safe haven for their destructive, bloody activities in one jurisdiction, but are able to in others, then our ability to stop them is greatly diminished, said Mr. Glenn. So the U.S. partners with numerous countries in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Latin America to help improve their enforcement, investigative, prosecutorial, and legislative capacities, and cooperation within and across governments. We are working to build connections between source regions of Africa, Latin America, and Asia for wildlife products with the demand countries. We do this by funding exchange visits and joint trainings to build trust, exchange information, and eventually take down whole networks of traffickers instead of individual poachers, said Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Glenn. The United States government will continue to lead global efforts to end the gruesome trafficking of elephants, rhinos, and other endangered species. We stand ready to work together with more partner nations in this effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, warring factions in South Sudan's civil war are scheduled to begin meeting in Ethiopia on Thursday, May 17th, in an effort to end the brutal conflict. Despite several agreements and ceasefires, the fighting continues. South Sudan in crisis. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many times when a man becomes sick with Ebola, it is the woman who cares for him. And then what happens? Then the woman becomes sick. And then who cares for the woman? The grandmother or a family member. Then the children can become infected, as well as others having direct contact with the sick person. This is how Ebola can pass from one person to another in the community. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.